Wish you knew more about the medical device industry and how you can do your job more effectively and put your career on the fast track? Then stay tuned while industry veteran Pat Cothey shares strategies and tips from customers and company insiders who help drive the industry. Now let's join Pat as he explores how you can master medical device.
Welcome. We've got a fantastic guest for you today. He's extremely interesting and also provides some great insights that we can put to use immediately to become better medical device professionals. Today's episode and the next several are going to focus on the most important people within the medical device space. You guessed it, they are our customers. We really need to understand our customers better if we're going to do our jobs properly. We need to know who they are, what they do, why they're doing it, and the issues that they're dealing with. Really, that's how we can best serve them and ultimately the patients. So let's get to today's guest. It's not often you're able to spend time with someone who imagined a brand new field of medicine and worked with industry to develop the tools necessary to realize his vision. Dr. Alejandro Berenstein is truly a pioneer and helped launch and develop what's referred to as interventional radiology or endovascular surgery, where catheter-enabled technologies are used to deliver therapy. He was born in Mexico City, received his advanced medical training in the Northeast U.S., and is currently a clinical professor and director of the pediatric cerebrovascular program at the Mount Sinai Health System in New York. He's offered the definitive books in his field and countless peer-reviewed articles. He served as the president of the most influential societies in his specialty and received more than 30 international awards in recognition of his important contributions. However, most importantly, he's had a profound impact on the practice of medicine and countless patients. Dr. Berenstein, welcome to Mastering Medical Device.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
We're all impacted by our pasts. To get things started, can you tell us what your childhood was like and how you came to medicine?
Well, I had a very good childhood. I was born, raised in Mexico City, a fabulous place to be at the time that I was growing up. I had very good parents, a good friendship, good relationship. So I had a very fortunate beginning. But I'll never forget, I was 11 years old. I wake up a Sunday morning and I come into my dad's bedroom and my dad is vomiting blood, just, you know, had an ulcer. And he was, obviously I didn't know that, but he was just vomiting blood and it was just a shocking thing and nobody knew what to do. And an emergency doctor came in and then they started doing, and I was in a stage that for the first time in my life, I didn't know what to do. And at that moment, I said, I need to learn. I need to be able to help people when some things like this happen. Second chapter is my best friend brother got into medical school. So I connected these two things. And then I saw that they were studying anatomy and they had a skull. And they had you can imagine, you know, a skull is something that, boo, you know, Halloween is here now with us. But it was very interesting to see in a different perspective the anatomy and how they were studying. And at that moment, I said, I want to be a doctor. I mean, it just hit me. So that was part of what happened when I was, I don't know, 14, 15 years old. I volunteered to the Red Cross, and I would go in the ambulance. It was fascinating. You learn because they do train you. You just don't go into the ambulance and go. So they train you to do. It did not, like what we have here in the United States, EMS, it wasn't that formalized, let's say. But they teach you a lot of things. And you would see broken bones and how to put it. And I obviously said, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do.
So now you know what you want to do. And it's time to get trained to do it. So you finished your medical school in Mexico City, but then decided that you wanted to come to the U.S. for further training. What was that like?
When you come to the United States, coming from a foreign country like Mexico, was really you get the job that nobody wants. You know, in other words, all the matching, there was no matching program; it was just starting. But you know, all the internships, they take the American graduates, and I understand. I think it's actually the way it is. So I got into Mount Sinai in Hartford, Connecticut. Now, I did not know United States at the Mount Sinai, St. Luke's, St. Francis. You know, the healthcare in those days was, there were little hospitals, but Mount Sinai was famous in Mexico. In Mexico, we only knew there was the Mayo Clinic and there were the Mount Sinai. So, you know, I said Mount Sinai, I thought they were all the same. You know, and as you know, they were very different. You know, Mount Sinai, Hartford, Connecticut was a 300-bed hospital. Not so hot, but it was a community hospital. And at the time, I was just with my wife. We just got married, and I was in a surgical internship. And my wife says, I'm going back to Canada. I said, why? I said, because I don't see you. You know, you're in the hospital all the time. Now, at the time, because my dad died from cancer of the liver, I saw for the first time in my life in Hartford, Connecticut, an angiogram. There was a radiologist that was putting a catheter in the renal artery, injecting X-ray dye. It was fantastic. And I said, bingo, if I can put the catheter to inject dye, why can't I put the catheter to put the medicine? And that's what really turned me on to it. In addition, when I was in Israel, I had in a military hospital, we had all the young soldiers. And I had a kid that actually taught me to play the game. We call it backgammon. It really is called shesh besh. It's a Persian game. They just play. These kids, they're playing all day long, and they're really good. So this soldier, this kid, taught me how to play the game, because I was an intern. I was all day and night in the hospital. And he gets a kidney infection. And we culture the kidney infection was Pseudomonas. And it was only sensitive to chlorampheniclol. Chlorampheniclol is an antibiotic. We gave him the chlorampheniclol, and the kid got an aplastic anemia. Very rare complication of the medication. And he died on me. And it was terrible. So I see this doctor putting a catheter in the renal artery, and I said, why don't I give the medicine in the renal artery and take it out from the renal vein? So it never becomes systemic. It never goes to the whole body. And go back to my wife. I said, you know what? I'll be a radiologist. You know, I'm not going to be a surgeon. I'm going to be a radiologist. Okay? His name was Mark, Dr. Moskowitz. Harold Moskowitz. So he was a real influence in my life. And he and I worked real hard because I was doing my internship, and then I would stay with him. And every time he had an angio, then he let me puncture the femoral artery. You know, that's a big thing when you're starting. And he helped me get the residency at Mount Sinai in New York. Because you in the United States, if you have a good recommendation, you work hard. No matter what prejudice there is in this country, you can make it. If you work hard, no matter where you come from, no matter how you look, you can make it. And so I got to go to Mount Sinai in New York. And from the beginning, I took radiology, which I was not very interested. The other side of the coin is radiology was very intellectual. You know, it's really, at first, at the beginning, they were looking at a chest X-ray. I said, what do they smoke here? I don't know. You know, they can look at things. It's incredible. And then when you start understanding, it's actually a very intellectual field. So it was, I think, a very good combination. My enthusiasm is, you know, surgical mentality. And then the intellectual aspect of radiology, I think, helped me a lot.
So let's set the stage a second. So we're in the early 70s, and radiology is much different than it is today. Cardiology is much different than it is today. So the interventional field did not exist. It did not exist in radiology or cardiology at that point in time. What was it like to be a radiologist? I mean, what was the main function of radiology at that point?
Well, the main functions is you are a doctor of doctors. You're a consultant. You know, but that doctor has a problem, takes an x-ray, comes with you, and he says, Mrs. Smith, she's got pain in the belly, and we took an x-ray of the belly. Remember, those days, there was no CAT scan. There was no MR. It was just x-rays, literally. So definitely, you are a consultant to doctors. But I already knew what I wanted to do. You know, I saw angiography. I said, this is the way to treat. It didn't exist. But to me, it was an obvious thing to do. So in Mount Sinai at the time was a 3-year residency in radiology. But on the third year, you could electively do half a year in the angio suite. And I volunteered. Now, the guy who was going to do the other 6 months bailed out. So I finished staying the whole year. And it's where I started, because the way it started is we had a patient bleeding to death, you know, so things come back. There's a gentleman had a gastric resection, and we're doing an angiogram, and I see from the left gastric artery, I inject dye, and I see the dye going out in the stomach. So I call my attending, and I said, this guy is going to die. We can save him. He says, how? I said, we'll put something to plug it. And we'll stop the bleed. Nobody can get there faster than us. He looked at me. His name was Harold Mitty. He looked at me and says, okay, so what do you do? So I took, there were some people in France already doing something. So they were using a thing called gel foam, which is a sponge. So I ran to the operating room. I got a piece of gel foam. I take the gel foam, cut it like that, and I plug the catheter. So I had to puncture the other groin, go back there, and I put a smaller piece. And I actually stopped the bleeding. So that moment, they took me to the chairman of the department. And my attendant says, look what he did. Look at this, what happened. And suddenly, things started happening. There was another case of a fracture of the pelvis, also bleeding. And they called me. Now I became the guy that every time they had a bleeder, they would call me. And that's how it started. So, you know, then came the brain. And the brain is different, because in the abdomen, you can do an exploration. You know, in those days, again, there was no MR. There was no imaging that we have today. There was no ultrasound. Ultrasound was starting at the time. So I thought that the brain, the EMA scanners just started. So I went to NYU, where they were doing little silicone sphere embolization for brain AVMs. They would open the neck, expose the neck, and take, you know, a Foley catheter, you know, cut the tip of the Foley catheter and just put it there and inject this silicone sphere. It was very crude, but it was the only place being done. There was a Dr. Ransoho, Joseph Ransoho. So I went, and I was through radiology, but he really adopted me. And I would stay after my radiology duties, and I would stay with them, make rounds with them. That's how I learned neurological diseases. And then we started embolizing brain AVMs, and there was nobody else. So I started getting them from New York, from different places, and then from New York State, and then from the country, and then things evolved.
So when you're on the bleeding edge, so to speak, when you're on the bleeding edge of medicine, there's risks associated with that. How did you look at that? How did you manage that?
First you have to be honest to yourself and try to help, not to hurt. But unfortunately, you are the last resource in sometimes of diseases that have no other alternative. So, I mean, you cannot function being afraid of being sued. But it was not as litigious as it is today. Those days, I'll tell you a story with crazy glue. You know, Dr. Kerber, he was in Pittsburgh at the time, started using cyanoacrylate, literally crazy glue. Cyanoacrylate from the, you know, and trying to inject it through catheters to block blood vessels for AVMs. So I started playing, and I had an animal lab. So before I ever tried anything in a human, I would play in either vitro or in vivo in an animal lab that I developed. You know, I took pieces of x-ray machines from one place to the other and built a whole lab. And eventually the company saw what I was doing, and I got a whole lab put by industry. So that's when I started my relationship with industry. I realized that if I'm good to them, they're good to me, and we help each other, and it's good for everybody. And that happens with catheters, and that happened with, of course, there were no tools. As a matter of fact, you know, famous John Abele from that created Boston Scientific, Meditech actually was the company in Boston, fantastic human being. He was afraid to do things for neuro. They thought that neuro was too risky. So nobody wanted to do things for neuro. So what John did is he would send me rolls of tubing. So with the rolls of tubing, we had to learn how to make catheters. So we would have 2-3 days before doing the procedure, we were actually literally making catheters, flaring them, the length, curving them, making the hub to put the lure lock. We learned all of that things had to be learned because nobody wanted to do it for us. So there was so I tell you, the most important is don't be afraid. Be honest and try to help. Because if you're not going to do something because you make it suit, you're not going to be good.
So not everyone is an inventor. Not everyone develops fields. What's different about you?
Not everybody knows how to sing. Not everybody is a painter. You know, my brain is made in such a way that I'm a problem solver. You know, and I think that people that have that type of mentality, I mean, look, I think everybody would agree that if I'm taller, I'm going to jump higher. I'm 5'3", you're 6'2", you're going to run faster than me. So there are parts of the brain. For example, I believe the musician probably have a better developed temporal lobe. A painter probably has a better developed occipital. I'm making it very simple. But I think that the architecture of your brain is such that why do you like mathematics? Because you're good. If you're not good, you don't like it. You know, so why? Because you have that part of your brain that where adding and, you know, there are regions in the brains which is better developed, like you have a bigger nose or smaller nose. I think that that's what happened. People say about being lucky. Luck doesn't exist. You have an opportunity, you see the opportunity, and you act upon the opportunity, you become lucky. So you have to have the mind for it, and then you have to see the opportunity and go with it, I guess.
Let's go back to the days that you were building your own catheters. So it's basically you are developing product for yourself. Tell me about how you viewed the technology at that point, what tools that you needed at that point, and how you were developing those, how you were thinking about those.
Well, first of all, I was young, stupid, and naive. I wish people would have liked to help me do it. But as I said, you know, John was very good because John taught me many things about how to do catheters, but we never talked about developing a product, commercializing a product. That didn't even came up to my mind. You know, I wanted to get smaller tube, softer tube. So then I had to find out. We found out actually, Dr. Kerber was a very also helpful person to me. Chuck is a real inventor. He's same specialty as myself. He's a neuroradiologist. He's a little older than me. He's an incredible inventor. So Chuck was very helpful. And he, for example, got Dow Corning to give him silicone tube. And silicone was a great, it was beginning of silicone. Silicone was very inert. So you didn't have problems of compatibility and so on. And it was very, very soft. So we started doing flow-guided catheters. That means catheters that you put in the body and you let the blood help you to propagate it up. And so, you know, so developing products was fun, you know, because we actually measured the patient to try to make a catheter big enough. You know, there was, you know, the beginning of Y adapters. Today is everybody takes things for granted, like we take TV for granted or telephone for granted. You know, when we started, those things did not exist. So you put it together and it would take me 2 days a week preparing for the next week cases. Okay, but then I was doing three cases a week, and that was a lot. you know, later on when industry helped us and catheters existed and et cetera, you know, when I, 10 years ago, I was doing 25 cases a week, you know, because the technology, the, and there were a lot of things in parallel. There was also imaging, you know, remember that all this endovascular technique is guided by x-rays. So that's where the radiology mixed with the surgery created the opportunity.
So you've been very generous in teaching other people different techniques. Back in those days, were you teaching other people how to make their own products?
Oh, sure. The problem I had in those times, nobody wanted to do it. So we wanted to be nice to attract people, you know, because when you start getting busy, you need to have a younger, it's really nice to have another person. I learned from Dr. Ransall, never be ashamed to ask. Never be ashamed to ask. Never worry that four eyes, no matter who they are, four eyes are better than two. So I always had the philosophy that having somebody to work with was better than working alone. So there was, and the best, you actually teach, and when you teach, you learn. Because you sometimes you don't make conscious, unless I explain it to you, then I make it conscious to myself, right? So I always found that it was actually a win-win.
So when you're out there developing different things, you get some clinical results and you publish those results, you go to meetings, you speak from the podium and tell people about your results. And then it starts a kind of a groundswell of, hey, other people want to do the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Today, when, as I said at the beginning, nobody wanted to do it. Nobody wanted to come. Today, look at it. Look what endovascular is. If you take, I mean, people said they're crazy and they were, cowboys. But you can even, the number of things that were said. I said some years later, I had one of those, then they give you keynote lectures. That's when you know you made it already. So I said, you know, look, it's very simple. We must be doing something right because everybody wants to do it. Neurosurgeons want to do it. Vascular surgeons wanted to do it. Even urologists today want to do it. Obstetrician, even people, I mean, just think, as we know how to navigate in the vascular system. And one thing, right now we're very good on the arterial side. We're coming to a new revolution, which is the venous axis. That means the highways are the arteries, highways, freeway streets, and the veins are the sewer system. And this is going to become very important in the management. Tissues don't eat from the arteries. The food comes from the arteries, but they eat at the venular level. So we're learning to navigate against the flow. And I think there's going to be amazing things that we're going to be able to do that way. Amazing things.
That's your next chapter.
We're on that one.
So let's kind of go back to that inflection point where you had been doing things individually, and now the broader medical establishment says, "Hey, I'd like to do that as well." So instead of making devices on your own, you turn to industry, and industry starts to get interested and get involved. How did that come about?
Well, again, I think that my relationship with John had a lot to do. We created but it was young and stupid. That I blame John, because he was in industry, but I was not. Do you remember when the Grundsec now comes into play? We tried to recruit him at NYU, but Atlanta gave him a better offer or whatever. So he went from Switzerland, he went to Atlanta. When he showed me the balloon catheters, and I was very much into double lumen balloon catheters. We had a problem in my field, contrary to opening the vessels, because remember, angioplasty is to open a vessel. I was into the world of embolization, which is closing. So I needed the largest possible ID, internal diameter, to be able to get devices, to be able to get particles, to be able to get things. At the time, the double lumen balloon catheters was the lumen for the balloon inflation was small, and the lumen for the, I don't know if you can see it, and the lumen for use was larger. And I said to myself, the balloon gets inflated with liquids. So why do I need to have, and look how much space I'm losing. So I came up with the idea of the smile, you know, to make the lumen where the balloon goes follows the wall of the catheter. Didn't patent it. I didn't know you could patent things. Every balloon catheter for angioplasty used it. Now they went into more coaxial. That means all around. We would have come up with that if, but you know, but so how? I was just happy they wanted to do it for me. I didn't realize that I could patent it, that I could get something out of it. No resentments. I learned, you know, in time. The other thing that happened is when I developed the Berenstain catheter, which even today is very popular, and the idea was to use a larger outer diameter, let's say 7 French, wire braided, that I did with USC, and then the distal part, make it a 5 French, very soft, but with the same internal diameter. So it was a variable stiffness principle with a variable outer diameter, but keeping the same ID. And that became the principle of what came after. The tracker catheter was based on that. But when I started at NYU, I did not know NYU was getting royalties. Then I found out that I'm supposed to get 50%. So I went to them and said, oh, yeah, we'll give you 50%. But again, I was naive and stupid. Yeah, they should have given me 50% from the previous 10 years. But I didn't know. I was happy they gave it from starting from now forward. But, you know, again, you live and you learn.
You're focused on the patient, but then you realize, hey, there's contributions I'm making that I should be compensated.
Right. This is, you know, you can't be a cowboy. I mean, a Boy Scout all the time.
So tell me about getting involved with companies and developing technologies.
I think that doctors that have the spirit, the ability to develop things can benefit a lot from a good relationship with industry. To me, it's important. I need to like the person. I need to like the engineer I'm going to do this work with. There has to be chemistry. I think that usually makes it more successful. There's many companies that are very honest, very straight. I think the key that I would recommend all doctors and scientists or whoever is to make sure that you have the idea well in your mind. Make sure that you write it down, make an illustration. Because what I learned also from then on is I've done many, many ideas and deals on a dinner with an engineer, and we take a napkin, and we take the napkin and we make a drawing. And we agree on it. And I said, okay, I learned what I have to. Okay, I want you to put here the date. And you put, and I put the date. And we both signed. So we have something, which is just a formality. But it's smart to do it. Because then later on, if something happens, they know that they signed something. And I think that it's better to prevent than to lament. You know, the best fight is the one you don't have. The best war is the one you don't have. So if you can do these little things, I would strongly recommend anybody who has an idea to make it to yourself, write down other things you can do. You can have a lab book, and you come up with an idea, and then you write it down. It's, the more explicit you make it, the better. And then have somebody, your teacher, your partner, somebody who is also in the field, read it and put in the note, read and understood, and sign it and the date. So if there's any kind of, you can prove that you had something and you had thought the idea before. So I learned all these little things that have become very, very helpful, because usually if I ever had to bring it out, you know, I said, look, we have this thing with, yeah, of course, no problem. So I've not had a single litigation with any company of all the things that I've done.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you've had the opportunity to work with a lot of different companies and develop a lot of different products and technologies throughout your career. How do you choose them, And if you can let us know what's a good relationship look like and what's a bad relationship look like?
A good relationship is you have to feel comfortable with the person. You have to feel that the person is honest. It is the best is if you actually admire the other person. And then the other person, the company that you see, if you see the company is not interested, don't push it. They're not interested. All you have to do, I told you, okay, let's just, and you send them a little, today you have email. So you said, it was a pleasure meeting you. We talk about the upside down catheter, thank you much. I see that you have no interest. Sincerely, yours. So you already closed that chapter. And then you, what happened is that our field is a small world. It's a small group of people. So you get to know people in the field. You meet them in meetings. Remember now we're in a peculiar period of human history with this COVID thing that we have, everything is on TV, on a screen. The meetings were terrific places it was the RSNA, for example, Radiology Society of North America, the interventional meeting. There's so much energy. There's the young doctor with a lot of enthusiasm. There's the young engineer. As passionate as I am on my side, Eric Engels, when we did the tracker catheter, he was as passionate as I am in what he was doing, And I met Eric. I saw him standing in a booth. He had this incredible variable stiffness catheter. Of course, that's why immediately my attention went there. But they didn't know what to do with it. Actually, they developed it for infusion to the liver. Which is interesting. Again, remember my father died from liver cancer, so I wanted to develop treatments. And today, the best treatment for liver cancer is actually endovascular, either chemoembolization or radioembolization. So at this stage of my life, I'm coming back. I have a new catheter that was using for that. So I think that the key is to get rapport. Of course, you have to go to a company that you know has the technology to do it. And they are more than just catheter companies. For example, I've had a fabulous relationship with imaging companies, with Siemens and they're the machine. I didn't get any money from it, but I would get his equipment. I would get the latest machines. And the way things evolve, you cannot get things for free anymore. So we had a very good arrangement, but the company wanted me to be exposed to their product for me to be able to advise them how to improve it. So there has to be a relationship. I do believe for things to be successful, there has to be a relationship.
It's beautiful when things work out and everyone is happy. Sometimes you may come up with an idea for a product and it could really help you out, but for whatever reason, the company decides it's not going to bring it forward for business reasons or for any other reason. Talk to me about that.
That unfortunately happens more often than not. Two things happen if you want to really be honest. I have, I don't know how many patents, 70, 80 patents. Most of them don't work. Okay. So, to have real success, they're not. But the problem that you mentioned is that you're convinced that the product is good. The company believes there's no market. I tell you, I was trying to do for many years a device to do biopsies of the endothelium. Very important in my field. It never panned out because they said this is a research tool. We're not going to be selling that. So I've developed some actually with private money, not for commercialization, but to prove the cost. But that's a very frequent, unfortunately, very frequent thing. And we doctors have never been trained to understand what is marketing, what it is to have something and figure out, I have two devices, which one should I develop? If I could say, well, this is going to be successful marketing-wise, obviously that's the one but medicine has many, many deficiencies in education. The worst one actually is nutrition. I never learned. Yeah, they tell you, actually it's wrong. They tell you to give milk when you have an ulcer. The worst thing you get, but this, and they used to be very popular. You take alkaline milk, no? But I did not have any kind of major education on nutrition, on physical exercise. we don't have also the cost of things. In medicine, you should train the doctors that the way they behave is what costs. It's very important. If I use three guide wires or four guide wires, I increase the cost of that procedure. Of course, it's not from my pocket, but we should be educated. And they also, I think we should be educated on how to develop products, how to develop drugs, how to develop things that can improve medicine. I think that it would be very useful to have at least an elective, not necessarily you're forced to it. But it's a good question that you posed me. You know, how do you, most of the time things don't, you know, you can work very hard, spend 2 years, 3 years, and nothing came out of it. I got a lot of prototypes. You come to my office, I got a whole bunch of prototypes there.
Well, you bring up an excellent point. And each of us has our own training. And you could benefit from some more on the marketing side. And obviously, we could benefit more understanding things from a physician side. I think that's the reason why we need each other. So let me switch gears for a second and talk about, you know, the changes that have occurred in medicine. It used to be that you could request anything and obtain that. Now we've got buying committees and buying groups, et cetera. Talk to me a little bit about how that's changed.
Well, I'm a little bit biased because my position in the hospital, you know, I'm very well respected within my own hospital. When you start, they think you're going to be a prima donna. When you just behave the right, I mean, they're very surprised, you know, oh, such a big doctor and all that. But look, he's very modest and he's, you know, so when I ask something, usually I have a good reason. But if I were to advise how to deal with it, is probably the best way to do it is to explain why you need the product, why you need the device, one. Two, create an interaction with the vendor and say, okay, you got this guide where you say it's fantastic. Best way to help for me to help you to get it into the hospital is let me try it. Let me try it. Let me have it here in the shell. I'm going to use the regular stuff I use. There will be the occasion, it always happens, that the tools I have is not working. And I will think about your product. I'll take your product and it saved me that thing. That's how I personally first become a believer in your product. Once I am convinced that it is helpful to the care of my patients, then I will help you to get it, because there is a whole process to justify, because usually a new product sometimes is more expensive than the one we have because it's got a prime situation, is unique, doesn't have the competition, etc. So I need to be convinced first. So I'm telling you, industry, you have to invest in the doctor so that the doctor feels comfortable. Then you have to invest by giving some samples, you know, some education about it. What is different about this product? You know, spend the time, then leave the product in the shell or have presence. If you can have your rep, have presence in the angio lab. Usually the doctor, he sees that the rep of that company, they usually use these products. It's a very classic thing. And then once I use the product, they perform better than what I was using, I will start on using it. Then I will go to my committee and say, hey, you know, let's say, for example, in our situation, we have the director of interventional radiology, you know, Rob Luxin. He's in charge. He's from our group, the one who goes to the committee to go to, you know, with administration to see what they approve. So then you go to that individual and you say, look, Rob, look at this case. I use this guide wire. It's fantastic. As a matter of fact, I think that if I have this guide wire, I can reduce the number of guide wires I use. Because usually what happens is if one guide wire doesn't use, you change and you take another one. And you take another one. If I have one that can do it from the beginning, now I got everything. I got reason, indication, familiarity, and justification.
So I imagine that you have a lot of sales representatives that are lined up to talk with you. What's the difference between a good sales representative and a bad sales representative?
The one is a pain in the neck that's bugging you and that's not going to get the hearing. And the other one is one that wants to learn. I would say that happens. I think it's a human condition. If I have a rep that is not nagging me like a salesperson, but is there, you see they're interested and they can say, excuse me, could you explain me what you did? That will, bring my attention. So I think that for reps, what I can recommend you is be modest. That means don't be pushy and be interested. And if you learn, you're actually going to be a better rep. If you understand the disease, a good rep knows the anatomy. A good rep knows the function of a device. A good rep can actually, because they see a lot of cases by different people. So a good rep can actually be an asset, and now you create a relationship with your customers, with your doctors.
So our healthcare system is changing too. How's it doing in your estimation, and where does it need to go?
Terrible. I mean, I tell you, the wealthiest country in the world, and we don't have medicine for everybody. Very disappointing. I think that medicine is a right. It's not a commodity. I think our system is crazy. You have everything, and from both right and left, they're wrong. I mean, we have a system that's super expensive, more expensive than anywhere else. I hate to say it. Fee for service is not good for healthcare cost. Fee for service, unfortunately, is human nature. If I have to treatment an aspirin of 25 cents or a stenting of the carotid, they both work well. And I do have my bias that what I do is better. Not necessarily for the money, but in addition from that, I get $2,000 versus $25. So the fee-for-service, I think, is something that we need to work on. I think that there have been some attempts. I think that having a healthcare where you have an insurance that really doesn't cover because you need to have out of pocket and you have, participate. I mean, this is insane. You go to France, Australia, actually. Australia is a model that we should, is very similar. The people is very similar to the United States, basically speaking. The doctors do very well there. They are in a fee-for-service like, but everybody has healthcare. It's the whole country. There's no deductible. There's no thing. So I think that we need to do something about the cost of healthcare is so, and the discrepancy between the have and have nots is so huge that it's sad. So it does bother me.
Well, you make some excellent points. And certainly it's a great challenge that we're trying to deal with, not only in the U.S., but worldwide. Some people have said that by trying to bring costs down, one of the byproducts of that is limiting innovation. What are your thoughts on that?
I think innovation will continue, even if you don't do the so-called, and this thing that you need to sell drugs so expensive to be able to pay for other drugs is a nice song, but it's not true. I think it's baloney. I think that if you have Germany, for example, where devices have, the government sets the price, a coil in Germany, the coils that we put for aneurysms, generally speaking, is 300 euros. We pay between $900 to $1,500. The same coil. Now, let me tell you, if the industry would be losing, would they sell it at $300? I would not. That philanthropy doesn't exist. So I think that we need a political system that is a little bit more, don't call me socialist, because not everything is the bigger profit I can make. I think industry in the United States will continue to be very successful. Innovation will continue because it's in our culture. We are a country of innovation. Am I going to stop thinking of a new device? I'm not going to stop thinking. Are you going to stop you're going to sell it. You're not going to make $1,000. You're going to make $400. You're going to make money. So I am convinced that that probably if we do this thing, there will be much wider spread. For example, the increase, if you insure everybody and you bring the cost of devices and drugs down, industry will do very well because there will be more people that can have it. You know what I mean? So I think, and we're a very creative society. Industry will find the ways how to make it possible. So I don't buy that thing that we need a very high price of devices and drugs to be able to innovate.
You mentioned before moving from the arterial side to the venous side. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes. In the treatment of arteriovenous malformation of the brain, we are at a stage that because we have learned to navigate through the venous side, we've also learned to contain the injection of liquids against the flow, called embolic containing device or embolic containing techniques. So we can now penetrate. But I'm thinking, for example, cancer. Cancer, a chemotherapy for cancer is the delivery of very high concentration of a toxic substance to destroy the bad tissue but preserve the good tissue. So if I can put it locally, and that's what the transarterial chemotherapy is doing, but you're going through the arteries, you irritate the arteries, you can thrombose the arteries, and you can produce ischemia. If you were to come from the venous side, the exchange of things is at the venular level. The venules is that group of blood vessels between the arterial and real venous system. And that's where the whole interaction, so if I can manipulate, I can come transvenous and I can flood that venular territory, I would be able to deliver, you name it. I'm even thinking about delivering, immunotherapy. You know, you can actually deliver things that is going to just target with nanotechnology. It's going to target the malignant cells and do nothing to the normal cells. So I think that I'm working on another thing to actually give treatment for a number of things, take biopsies. As I said, we're going through, if I don't need to open your head and I can go to a real area and take a little sample, wouldn't it be attractive?
Absolutely. The other thing I think is absolute is that as this field is developing, you're going to be at the forefront and helping lead that development. Well, Dr. Berenstein, we're approaching the end of this this podcast, and as you know, the listeners of the podcast work in all functional areas of medical device companies, not just sales and marketing, but manufacturing, engineering, quality, regulatory, et cetera. Is there anything you would like to say directly to people within the industry?
Well, I think you guys are extremely important. I think you people in industry are part of the partnership. I don't think we can reached what we've reached without you. I think that if I were to recommend what best to do is to get passionate to what you do. Think that you are going to help people, that the devices and the things that you're going to be involved are going to be more than you're just going to make a living. You're going to help treat and you're going to help society to get better. Develop friendship with the doctors. Doctors are egomaniacs. You just got to understand that. You know, our society makes doctors believe that they're some. Another schmuck, but I don't know it's good for your. But it's another person, just like you, no different than you. Treat them with respect and you will receive respect. There will be doctors that are very egomaniacs and just let it go. Best thing is don't argue with them, but create friendships, create relationships, because you want, if I have an idea and I like Patrick and I have an interaction, I'm going to bring it to Patrick. You want the doctor to bring the ideas to you and get a first shot at it. So I do believe that interactions and relationships are part of human behavior. And I think that if you are in this part of the equation, this part or that part is the same. We need each other to be able to advance, but we have great future. There's only one limit, imagination.
What a pleasure to speak with Dr. Berenstein. A few of my takeaways. True leaders share the spotlight. He acknowledged people that helped him along the way. He talked about teachers, professors, colleagues, staff, engineers, and people within industry. It really was remarkable to hear him mention by name some of the people who were critical to his success. When he said, "Not everyone knows how to sing, not everyone's a painter," it reminded me that we should amplify our strengths, not only look at our weaknesses, but how do we amplify our strengths? His take on luck was revealing. Luck doesn't exist. You have an opportunity, you see the opportunity, you act upon the opportunity, you become lucky. What great words. And finally, there's only one limit, imagination. So good. Now for your action item. I'd like you to select one of your products and find out who was behind it. Get to know the history of the clinician and also the people on the product development team that made it happen. You may find a story that's just as interesting as a little boy in Mexico City whose interest in medicine began when he saw his father suffering and decided to become a doctor while viewing a skull, and then used his imagination to enable a whole new field of medicine. Thanks for listening. Please spread the word and tell a friend or two to listen to the Mastering Medical Device podcast, as interviews like today's can help you become a more effective medical device leader. Work hard. Be kind.